Acts chapter 19 is where we're going to be this morning. I have missed being in Acts. I know it doesn't seem like it's been that long, but it feels like it's been forever to me. And I feel like a fish out of water when we're not, you know, preaching through a book of the Bible. We took a little a topical series about giving of ourselves, of our finances, and today we're getting back into what I'm way more comfortable with, which is really just going into the Word and line by line, verse by verse, seeing what God has for us. Acts 19 is where we're going to be this morning in verses 21 through 41. While you're getting there, I'll start with this. I'm a very GPS or Apple Maps or Google Maps dependent person when it comes to places I've never been. In fact, that's true of sometimes even places I have been. I still have a struggle time like getting, you know, when you come down Poplar Springs and you're going into the downtown area, like in that way, passing by like I think Shipley's used to be there and the Daily Grind on the left. Coming that direction, going into downtown, passing the hospital, I have no clue where I am still. I mean, it's for 5 years, okay? And I still am like, Google, I need you, okay? I'm a very Google Maps dependent person, but I'm old enough to remember, some of you guys are a little bit older and are like, shame on you. You don't know how it used to be. Well, that's kind of true. I do remember MapQuest. Do you guys remember MapQuest? We had to print out pieces of paper, and it was like, you're going to go this far, and then you're going to take this turn, and this far, and then you're going to take this turn. My parents let me go on an overnight. I'm talking about overnight. We left at like 7 p.m. to Orlando, Florida, using MapQuest, and we got to Georgia. And I'm like, I don't think we're supposed to go to Georgia, y'all. That was one of the scariest nights of my life, okay? I'll tell you more about the story another time. But I'm old enough to remember MapQuest, but those of you who navigated road trips using those fold-out maps that were the width of your vehicle, that's crazy, all right? I don't know how you did it. You're kind of amazing. You're superheroes to me. That's amazing to me. I don't know how you did that. You ever get a call, like maybe now that you're dependent on Google Maps like I am, and you got it like sitting up on your dash or something, and then somebody calls you, and you're like, hey, our friendship may be over, but I have to hang up on you or else I'm going to die out here. I don't know where I'm going. You have a mini panic attack because someone rings you and you're like, I don't know where I'm going. I'm going to, you know, get lost in this wilderness if I don't tell you to, so I got to hang up on you. You go from panic to peace then as you end the call, from wilderness to wayfinder with your map, right? The reason I say that is this, that early Christians, they weren't just called Christians or believers or churchgoers. They were called and known as the Way. We see this term, the Way, mentioned several times in the New Testament. In the book of Acts, you see it mentioned six times. The big idea this morning is something we're going to take from them, and that is that your faith isn't just a belief system. It is a direction. It is a path. It is a journey to follow. For them, their faith wasn't just a belief system. It was a direction, a path, a journey to follow. The only other term that is used more by this author, Luke, the only other term that's used more to describe this following, this thing that they're committed to, the only other term that Luke used more than the Way was the term disciples, which just means followers, followers of the Way. 25 times he uses that term disciples, 6 times he uses the term the Way. We don't really use the term the Way unless we're quoting John 14:6, where Jesus said, I am what? He said, I'm the Way, the truth, and the life. We've kind of gotten away from that as our main term to describe this thing. We say Christianity or followers of Jesus. But I want to just get back to the basics for a moment and just introduce to you this idea of the Way and why the early church was known to be followers of the Way. And the reason why is because they weren't just learning about Jesus. They were committed to walking in his footsteps. And nothing's changed. That's the same thing that we should be committed to. It's not just a belief system. It's not just a religion. It is a direction. It's a path. It's a way that we are called to follow. Otherwise, life is aimless and purposeless and pointless panic apart from him. But in him, there's peace. He is our wayfinder. See, the question for us today is this. Are you simply learning about Jesus, subscribing to a belief system, or are you actually committed to following the Way? Is Christianity to you a belief system, or is it the Way? Today, we're going to look in Acts 19, verses 21 through 41, And I really think we're going to see some neat things here as we talk about that subject matter. All right, let's see it. Acts 19, verses 21 through 41. It should be on the screen behind me. And hopefully you got a copy of God's Word. We are really going to be committed to the Word. We are always. And so line by line, we're going to look at this thing. All right. It says this. Now, after these events, Paul resolved in the spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and go to Jerusalem, saying, after I've been there, I must also see Rome. And having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. About that time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen in similar trades and said, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. And there's a danger, not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship. When they heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. So the city was filled with confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, who were Paul's companions in travel. But when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. And even some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of his, sent to him and were urging him not to venture into the theater. Now some cried out one thing and some another, for the assembly was in confusion. And most of them didn't even know why they had come together. I think that's a funny verse. Some of the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward. And Alexander, motioning with his hand, wanted to make a defense to the crowd. But when they recognized that he was a Jew, for about 2 hours, they all cried out with one voice, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. And when the town clerk had quieted the crowd, he said, men of Ephesus, who is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? Seeing then that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash. For you have brought these men here who were neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. If therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly. For we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today, since there is no cause that we can give to justify this commotion. And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly. We took a little bit of a break, and so I'm going to revisit something real quick. We talked about Artemis a little bit last time, and I'm going to show you some things on the screen to sort of paint a picture in just a few moments. But what we really have seen, and this is true not just in chapter 19, but it's really been true, and not just in Ephesus, but it's been true all over the Roman Empire, starting even in Jerusalem, where the church sort of began, and that is that God's territory is expanding, and it is a threat to all the territory around it. My family loved to play Risk when I was growing up. You guys know I'm talking about the board game Risk. I think I might have mentioned that before. And I love playing that game, especially with my dad's dad, who's with the Lord now. We would play Risk together. And that game is this game where you put these armies on this, it's the world map. And it's all about dominating the territory. And you have the whole map there, and you're trying to build your armies and take over the other person's armies. So right at the end of the game, it's just your guys that fill up the entire globe. And the thing about that game is, as one man's armies increase, as your territory increases, the other person's necessarily decreases. This is what's happening in the early church, is that God's territory is expanding. Now, everything belongs to God, right? But what I'm saying is, the Christian movement, the way, is really expanding and expanding and expanding, and it's reaching so many territories that quote-unquote rival goddesses and gods and their followers are beginning to be a little uncomfortable. Well, hold on now. You're encroaching on our territory. This is the territory of Artemis. And as we said last week or last time we were here, this town ain't big enough for the two of them, right? You see, this is God's territory expanding. That's why I've decided to call this walk through the book of Acts the word forward. In a word, that's what this is. It's God's movement, the way going forward. You see, a new God, so to speak, has arrived in Ephesus. And what we saw last time, if you remember, was that they even were burning relics of Artemis's reign among them. As Christ has increased, literally what belonged to Artemis is decreasing. Now, I want to look real quick at the first couple of verses here, 21 and 22. These are itinerant verses. They just tell us what's going to happen next. And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but I'm going to reread them. Now, after these events, Paul resolved in the Spirit of God, to pass through Macedonia and Achaia, remember those terms, and go to Jerusalem, saying, after I've been there, I must also see Rome. He's not saying this because he wants to vacation to Rome, okay? He's not saying, I got to see Rome, man. I got to go to see Rome before I die. That's not what he's saying. He says, I got to go on mission to Rome, the hub, like the center, the epicenter of our world. He says, and having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. Now, as you know, where we see a lot of terms and names like this, we have one very important responsibility, and that's to look at a map. So that's what we're going to do. Would you mind showing us our lines map? All right. So real quickly, Asia is not what we know as Asia. It's modern day like Western Turkey. And so this is the big red area right there is Asia. Ephesus is right there. And some of the regions that we've heard about are Achaia, which is here. What Paul has said is, I need to go to Achaia. I need to go to Macedonia, this big region here and this region here. Notice that there are churches there that he's already visited. If you've been with us for a while, he's already been to Athens and planted a church. He's been to Corinth and planted a church. Those two are down here. He's also been to all these places up here, Philippi, Apollonia, Thessalonica, known as Thessaloniki even today, and Berea. I say that to say, what he's saying is, I need to go to these places. And you'll notice that this is Paul's third missionary journey. It started in Antioch, and he's made his way here, and he stopped so far right there. And eventually, he will go all the way here, as it says he will. But it says he doesn't quite do that yet. It says, I'm going to hang back in Asia for a while, so in the middle there, at Ephesus for a while, and he sends forward a couple of his traveling companions. Now, he makes plans to keep going and strengthen the churches in those areas and the believers in those areas, but he sends these co-laborers forward as he hangs back. Now listen, the reason I say that is we have been really tracking closely Paul as we've gone through this book, especially the second half. But in this text, did you notice something? He's kind of a bystander. Like Paul is not really active in this passage so much, but he is the indirect cause of this conflict where God is increasing and encroaching on the world's gods and the world's values. If you're taking notes this morning, I got a couple things that I want to leave you with. Number one, as we talk about the way, is that the way is our highest value. The way, that is walking with Jesus, following in his footsteps, putting him as number one, as priority, he must be our highest value. And the reason I phrase it that way is because we are going to see a rivalry of value, an economic issue as such. You see, this surging message of Jesus doesn't just cause religious conflict. Do you see how this conflict begins? We're going to read it again in a second. It's an economic conflict. That's how it really starts. It starts with money. Look at verses 23 through 25. It says, about that time, there arose no little disturbance. That's Luke's way of saying a big problem, a big conflict. No little disturbance concerning the way. So the way of Jesus is at center stage here. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines, little idols of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. It says, these he gathered together, these would be the craftsmen, the people that he was giving money to here, with the workmen in similar trades and said, here's your conflict. Men, you know that from this business of building altars and or shrines and idolatry, we have our wealth, he says. The word for in verse 24 gives us the reason for this disturbance, and that is that so many people in this province had turned to Jesus in Asia. West, by the way, it's not just in Ephesus. Did you notice it said Paul is taking his message and it's reaching most of Asia? You saw it on the map. I'm not going to put it back up there. It's a lot. That's a lot of landmass that the gospel is permeating a long, long distance. These people are feeling this impact. This movement of Jesus, this entire industry of workers is feeling that their way of life is being threatened. It talks about craftsmen, workmen. It mentions this guy, Demetrius. You see, they depended on Artemis's following for their income. This is not, please listen to this, this is not an ethical conflict. This is not a moral conflict. This is not a religious conflict. This is an economic conflict. This is about money. This is about value. This is about you're hitting me in my wallet. And I got a problem with Jesus because it is changing and making me uncomfortable. I want to show you a couple of images because I keep talking about that goddess Artemis. We looked at this, I think, 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago at the part where we dropped off. Will you show that temple picture, please. This is the Temple of Artemis, and this is just an artist rendering. It may not have looked exactly like this, and I even showed a different one when we looked at it that was even more ornate with some of the things on the outside. But the reason I like this image is that it sort of shows us sort of a skeleton view or a 3D view of what would be on the inside. This right here, this massive statue, would be the statue or the idol of Artemis. And I know you can't really see that, but I'm going to describe a little bit of what this looks like. I do want you to see, by scale, all these little people down here. This place was enormous. The Temple of Artemis. Artemis was the virgin daughter, and again, this is a pagan goddess. She's not real, but she was the virgin daughter of Zeus. If you have the King James or the New King James, your Bible may say Diana. That's because she would be the Roman equivalent of the Greek god of Artemis. And it's the Latin, the KJV uses the Latin, and the Latin says Diana, which is why it says that. It would be an understatement to say that the worship of Artemis was dominant in Ephesus. A massive understatement. She was known as the Queen of Heaven. They called her Lord. They called her Savior. Does that sound familiar? According to their beliefs, she wielded power and authority, this is going to sound familiar, in heaven and on the earth and under the earth. She's associated with fertility, health. She helped and protected women in childbirth. Again, this is their system of beliefs. She has this massive temple, four times the size of the Parthenon, which we looked at a few weeks ago. Huge temple. It's one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, by the way. Now, I know you can't see it, but I'm going to describe what this idol looks like because it's pertinent. So there's this big statue. She has a headdress and a zodiac necklace. The zodiac necklace was there to typify or symbolize that she had power and control over fate and control over the stars. She's got these animals that are sort of sculpted into her torso, as well as these orbs, and these orbs are symbolic of eggs and fertility and life. She's known as having control over wildlife, control over nature. She was known for benevolence to Ephesus. They believed that she was their protector and their savior. And the reason things are prosperous in Ephesus is because we got this big temple right here, is what they thought. This is a big deal. And so Demetrius, bringing this all home, Demetrius made these many statues or these many shrines that people would put in their homes and their workplaces. And now put the math together. If less people want that because they're not following that anymore, what's that going to mean for Demetrius and his family? It's going to hit him. It's an economic issue. And he's rallying the troops behind him and say, hey, we got to squash this Jesus movement the way. Look at verses 26 and 27. He continues, and you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. Imagine that. Imagine saying that, right? And there is danger, not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, and this is what he says to kind of rally the troops. It really is only about the economic issue, but he says, but also that the temple of the great goddess of Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all of Asia and the world worship. You see, to be vocal about following the way, it meant the economic and cultural boats of this culture would be rocked. In other words, it sounds kind of like this, using and paraphrasing these guys' words. It's kind of like, you can believe, okay, Christians, you can believe what you want until it becomes a problem for us. Does that sound familiar? Come on. I mean, that sounds a little familiar to where we live, right? You can believe what you want until it kind of encroaches on what we got going on. I want you to ponder this. Here's what it reminds me of, and this is not a political statement. This is a biblical worldview statement. The approach of Demetrius, it reminds me of an industry in our culture, and it's the industry of abortion, the industry of death for pay. It's made to look like a moral issue. Did you notice how Demetrius tried to make it look like a moral issue? He paints it to look like a moral issue, a social issue, when in reality, it's an economic issue. It's a pride issue that should sound like the issue that I mentioned just a moment ago. You see, in the overwhelming majority of cases, and follow me for a second, in the overwhelming majority of cases, there are exceptions for this, but in the overwhelming majority of cases, abortion is the altar of one's inconvenience. Where that which is offered as a sacrifice is that which has gotten in the way. And while, please listen to this, if that has hit you home, if your daughter or someone that you love or yourself, while that is not the unforgivable sin, I'm going to say that again, that is not the unforgivable sin. While it's not the unforgivable sin, abortion is incredibly anti-gospel. Why do I say that? Because whereas the gospel is Jesus saying, I'll die for you, abortion is someone saying, you'll die for me. You see, it is absolutely a social issue, that is. But as with most multi-billion dollar industries, those who stand to lose are quick to stir up the mob. Demetrius stood to lose, and it hit him in his bank. And so as a result, he stirred up the mob. It was not a moral issue. It wasn't about social justice. It was about money. And the culture, and the conflict of the culture and the church can be packaged in many ways, but at the core, this issue centers around a culture that is bothered that the way is infringing on their highest value. And the highest value of our world right here is self. But church, and again, I'm not making that a political issue. It's a biblical worldview issue. But church, I want you to hear me say something. We only kneel to one altar. And it isn't the altar of Planned Parenthood. It is the throne of the Lord Jesus Christ. He is our highest value. And look, I select that one industry because I think that it's a good parallel to what's happening in our passage. And I don't want to hunker there anymore because I don't want to deviate from the point that we're trying to get at here. I select that one industry, but there have been many others in past and will be many more in the future. My point is this. When you align, please listen, when you align yourself with Jesus, he becomes your highest value. And eventually, our playbook does not jive with the playbook of the world, and we must choose to stand firm no matter the cost. That's where we are right now. That's where these guys are. So as we progress in the story, I want to just take a pause, just for a second, as I just did. We're going to move on now. But just take a pause, and I want you to see that the fever pitch in our passage is very simple. It is the value of the world and the value of the way, the followers of Jesus. Eventually, there will be friction. And we don't bow to the world. We bow to the Lord Jesus. So with that in mind, that's the conflict. I want to look at the second thing. The second thing is that the way, second main point here on the screen, the way is disruptive, but it is not destructive. The way is disruptive, but it is not destructive. And sometimes we can wrongly think that those two things are the same. They are not the same. The way is disruptive, but it is not destructive. You see, Demetrius tries to make this a moral or religious issue, but we know better. It's a money issue. It's an economic issue. It's a selfishness issue. Still, he has to rile up the crowds to win the conflict, and so he does so through making it something bigger than it actually was. And this is where the passage kind of develops. Look at verses 28 and 29. It says, when they heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. It's almost written to say, no, God's not great. Jesus is not great. Great is Artemis. She's the great one, right? 29. So the city was filled with the confusion, and they, check this term out here, they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, who were Paul's companions in travel. There's a lot to unpack there. I'm going to go through it very quickly. It mentions two guys that they drag into this theater. These guys' names are Gaius and Aristarchus. It says that they're missionaries for Macedonian churches. Can you put that map up there one more time for me, buddy? Buddy, sorry, that was weird. All right, so Macedonia. Hey, Greg, you remember that time I called you Gary when I was here for like 2 weeks? That was funny. All right. Macedonia is here. The guys that I just mentioned, Gaius and Aristarchus, are from this region. Sorry for bringing that up again, Gary. Gaius is from Corinth, and Aristarchus is from Thessalonica. I said they're from Macedonia, so Corinth would be here. This is Gaius. Aristarchus from up here in Thessalonica. The reason I say that is that these are guys that Paul has picked up along the way on his missionary journeys, and now they're associated with Paul, and while Paul's not the center of the conflict, he is, but he's not, they drag these two guys in there. We know that Gaius traveled with Paul, or Gaius was baptized by Paul, and Aristarchus traveled with him and was imprisoned with him even. These guys are buddies of his. It says, look back with me, where is it? Verse 29. It says, they rushed together. These are important terms. Rushed together, the crowd did, where? Into the theater, where they dragged these guys into the theater. This theater, I want to show you an image of it, all right? These are ruins that are still there, the theater of Ephesus. Would you put that up there? How about that, man? Isn't that crazy? So this is the theater. It had a seating capacity at that time of 12,000 people. 12,000 people, and I don't know what it looked like exactly then, but this is the image. I want to just paint the scene because you can kind of picture it. They drag these two believers into this space. Crowds are, and I don't know if it's at capacity or not, but there's enough people there that it was very confusing and people chanting different things. They drag him before this huge crowd, and it says, this verb is so interesting. It says they rushed together. That term, this is interesting. That term rushed together is only used by Luke one time in the book of Acts. Do you know what it is? It's the martyrdom of Stephen. It's when Stephen was stoned. Luke does not use that term on accident. The reason he says that is that I want you to understand this is a scary, scary, scary scene. There's a lot of danger at stake here. And so Paul wants to intervene. That makes sense. That's Paul's style, right? Look at verse 30. But when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. Well, that makes sense, right? The disciples, these are fellow believers protecting Paul. But listen, I want to contrast that with what happens next. This next part is interesting. Fellow believers protect Paul, but look what it says in verse 31. And even some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of his, sent to him and were urging him not to venture into the theater. Now, who are the Asiarchs? I know this is a deep history lesson, and I don't mean to get into the weeds here, but this is important. The Asiarchs were high-ranking Roman officials of the widespread Roman Empire that were stationed there in Ephesus. I've shown you this before, but would you mind putting that Roman Empire map up there, please? Ignore the gray boxes and the pink line. I used that before. I want you to see this massive space. The red space is the Roman Empire. Now, the place that we're in right now in Ephesus is, where are we at? Right there, all right? Right there. I want you to see that because the empire was enormous, widespread influence. But it didn't, I mean, it's Roman. It started in Rome. Where's Rome? Rome's over here, right there, okay? Ephesus is way over here. There was Roman influence in Jesus' day in Jerusalem, which, by the way, is way over on this side. There was, I don't know how to explain this, but it'd be very simple. There was culture in Ephesus, Ephesian culture, before there was Roman culture, just like there was culture in Israel before there was Roman influence in Israel. So the Ephesian culture was a cult of Artemis culture, not a Roman culture. These are two different things, is what I'm trying to get at. The reason I say that is that these Asiarchs were Roman officials that were concerned, very important, they were not concerned with the worship of Artemis. They were concerned with the worship of the Roman emperor. They were Rome over everything, patriotism, order, justice, prosperity, military supremacy. And here's why I say that. This is awesome to me. They're friends of Paul's. These guys are friends of Paul's. Paul wasn't just protected by fellow Christ followers. He was protected by Roman officials that liked him. Remember, he'd been in Ephesus for 2 years. The Christians were concerned with the safety of their fellow Christ follower, but the Asiarchs were concerned with their fellow Roman citizen. It says he was a friend of theirs, these unbelievers like Paul. Look at verses 32 through 41. I'm going to read the rest of it and make a few observations as we go. Now, some cried out one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them did not know why they had come together. Some of the crowd prompted Alexander. We're not going to spend a lot of time here. We're not really sure what Alexander's motive is, probably distancing the Jews from other Christians, just to say, hey, this isn't our problem. Let's leave us out of it. It says, Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward, and Alexander, motioning with his hand, wanted to make a defense to the crowd. But when they recognized that he was a Jew, for about 2 hours, they all cried out with one voice, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. 2 hours, by the way. 2 hours. And when the town clerk, we're going to talk about him in a second. This is a new individual. When the town clerk had quieted the crowd, he said, men of Ephesus, who is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? Seeing then that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash. For you have brought these men here who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. We'll talk about that in a second as well. If therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open. There are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly, meaning do it the right way, do it in court. For we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today, since there is no cause that we can give to justify this commotion. And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly. Verse 35 says that this city are they're temple keepers of Artemis. By the way, that term temple keepers, this is so fascinating to me. It was a term, temple keeper, they kind of hung their hat on this because it was like, we're the place that has the temple of Artemis. I mean, we're kind of a big deal. It was such a big deal that that term temple keeper was in Greek was inscribed on Ephesian coins. They were really, really big on this whole thing about we got Artemis, the temple of Artemis right here. This town clerk was a chief administrative officer in the city. He says something interesting, though. He says that these Christians, Gaius and Aristarchus, and obviously Paul by proxy, he says that they are not, this is weird, right? He says they're not sacrilegious, and they're not blasphemers. You may think, what? They're speaking out against Artemis, right? That seems weird. What he means is that they offer no physical threat to the cult of Artemis. The Ephesians were sensitive because in their history, people had attempted to deface this temple, vandalize the temple, or even destroy or burn it down. This guy's point is that these men had not stolen any idols. They had not defaced any property. They've committed no crimes against Artemis or against any of you guys. He says, let's dismiss this thing. We have courts for this. Here's why I say all that. These Christians are not against a peaceful Roman world. They're here for it. I'm going to make an application to that in just a moment. These Christians are not against a peaceful Roman world. They are for it. It's strange because in a book, Acts, that often pits Christianity against the world, there are times, that's true, in a sense, it's true. There are also times like this where Luke offers an interesting reminder, and this is it. This is so interesting to me. See this on the screen behind me. That even unbelieving people who care about order and justice and civility and human flourishing should protect and welcome the way's influence. We've seen this once already in Philippi, and now we see it again in Ephesus. Even unbelieving people who care about order and justice and civility and human flourishing should protect and welcome the influence of the way. We as Christians are not against a peaceful, flourishing American society. Are we not? We're for it, aren't we? We're for it. So listen, I'll ask you a question. Is Christianity disruptive to society? Think about it. Is Christianity disruptive to society? I would say the answer is yes. But is Christianity destructive to society? Absolutely not. I'll give you an example. You want to tell you something that was disruptive to our society? It's still happening. It's the digital world. Yeah. Everything going from paper, everything to digital, everything, that has been a very disruptive thing in our society. And I think it's been disruptive for the better. Everything going digital. Some of you guys that have been around a little while are saying, I don't know about that. I kind of prefer the old way. Well, hear me out for a second. I remember in 2007, I had a cell phone. I had this little LG phone. And it was really when people first started texting a lot. You know what I'm talking about? Do you guys remember that? People really started texting for the first time a lot, and it kind of, there was this pivot that young people started to prefer texting over making phone calls. I remember having a conversation with my dad, and I don't remember what he said, but I said something like, hey, Dad, just text me. And I remember him, if y'all knew my dad, this would be way funnier, but I remember him saying, mocking me and saying, just text me, like that. You text, like, almost like I was like, I don't know, a loser for that. I'm like, come on, Dad, like, I'm your son. Love me. But I remember him mocking me. Just text me, saying a phone call is better. If you can do it, just call me. Do it in a phone call. But now the only time that he wants to talk to me on the phone is when my kids are with me. You know what he wants to do? Text me. You know why? Because the digital world disrupted. But didn't it not? It didn't destroy. Like that's not the... Clearly, you know, you start to see the way. And look, we got so many examples of this. You got Zoom. What an awesome thing Zoom has become. Working from home, that's a blessing for a lot of you guys. Everything's paperless. I'm thankful for that. You got the cloud, whatever the cloud is, you know. We got storage that's been redefined. Multi-billion dollar data centers. It's like you couldn't even fathom that 30 years ago or less than that. Our society has been turned upside down by the digital shift. But though disruptive, right? Disruptive to our way of life. I love that I can pay my bills online and instead of having to buy a stamp every single month for every single one of those bills. That was a disruptive change. But for me, it has been a welcome change. I say that to say this. Not all disruptions are destructive. So is Christianity disruptive to society? Yes. Is Christianity destructive to society? No. You see, the way of the cross brings healing, not hurt. I think you'll see that on the screen behind me. The way of the cross brings healing, not hurt. Is it disruptive? Yes, but it brings healing, not hurt. One of the things that we mentioned just a few weeks ago is this gift of what it is to be salt and light to the world. Jesus cared so much about that terminology, salt and light, that he used it in his Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, 13 through 16. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll just summarize. He uses these two images, salt and light. He mentions that you, my followers, you are light to the world. What he meant was that the good works of Christ's followers are to shine for all to see, that they may come to know Jesus. He's the light of the world, and we are light to be shown to them. He illustrated that by saying, you don't get a lamp and then shut it in a closet. Why does a lamp exist? It is to brighten the space that it dwells. And that's what believers are. We're light, but we're also salt of the earth. You may have heard that phrase a few times, but not really been able to put your finger on what that means. It means that, I'll put it this way, salt had two purposes in the Middle East in the first century. The first purpose was preservation. Because of the lack of refrigeration, salt was used to preserve food, especially meat, which would quickly spoil in the desert environment. And so believers are preservatives to the world, preserving it from the evil society that is corrupted by sin. We are salt, preservatives in this world. Good for society, in other words. The other function of salt in the early world is the same function that it has today. Flavor enhancer, right? We had our men's gathering last night, and there was a lot of salt going on those steaks. And I'm thankful for that. Because that's what salt does, right? It enhances flavor. In the same way that salt enhances the flavor of the food that it seasons, what does it mean that we're salt? Well, followers of Christ stand out as those who enhance the flavor of life in this world. As salt makes a steak better, believers who walk with Jesus should make this world better and reflect the heart of our God. I'll put it this way. The way, and I think everybody wants human flourishing. We all want that, right? True human flourishing is not found in an economy. It's not found in moralism. It is found in the person and work of Jesus. You see, Lauderdale County would be better. Let's think about Judeo-Christian values for a second. Christ-following values. Lauderdale County would be better if more marriages stayed intact. But it's disruptive, right? Because it is disruptive to say divorce is a problem, infidelity is a problem, and Jesus has the answer for that problem. It's disruptive, but it brings healing. Lauderdale County would be a better place if more dads were spiritual leaders who dove into the Bible and prayer and had examples of the gospel in their homes. But that's disruptive. You know why? Because men don't exactly like being told how to be real men. It's disruptive. But does that destroy homes or does it bring healing to homes? This would be a better place if more people exemplified sacrificial living and generosity and patience and kindness. But the disruption there is that it disrupts our natural tendencies toward things like selfishness and greed. This would be a better place if there was less drunkenness. But the disruption there is disrupting patterns of alcoholism and addiction. We would have a better society if there was less sexual sin that led to diseases and unplanned pregnancies and abortion and abuse and trauma. But the disruption there is telling people that it's not my body, my choice, but my body for God's glory. That's a disruption. But it is not destruction. It brings healing. Be a better place if there was less violence, less sin. But the disruption is telling people that their best life is to agree with God, not live your own way. I'll say it this way, that the best society is not one where Christians are silenced, but one where Christians loudly stand for biblical principles and influence the world in Jesus' name. And I get that from the fact that these Asiarchs looked at Paul with favor. It's possible for your lost coworkers and friends to see that you are good for their life, even if they don't subscribe to the way. You can give a good reputation to Jesus in our world. But man, as I say that, please listen to this. There is only one way for our city, our county, our state, and our nation to be healed. It isn't through politicians or policies or prosperity or moral performance. It is through the powerful and perfect saving work of Jesus, because the cross is the way to healing, not hurt. Is the cross confrontational? Not a rhetorical question. Is the cross confrontational? Yes. It is. It's disruptive. It confronts. It convicts. But it also cleanses. It brings healing. The way is the key to human flourishing. And revival
It happens on the large scale when God's people surrender and find revival on the personal scale. You know, this is a weird passage, and I was wrestling with this because it ends so abruptly. Did you notice that? And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly. It's not exactly an action ending, right? It's like a town hall meeting that just everybody goes their own way. And I struggled with this thinking, what do I do with that? What do I say about that? But I think that this is what needs to be said. Where do we identify in the passage? If you walk with Jesus long enough, and I don't think it takes long, I think that you'll quickly find that as you walk with him, he disrupts your heart. My prayer this morning and this week has been that God would disturb you. Some of you guys have become far too comfortable in your sin, far too comfortable pushing him away, far too comfortable numbing yourself and making your faith a system of beliefs instead of a way, the way of life. My prayer for you today is that God would disrupt you, not for your destruction, but for your healing. And some of you guys know what I'm talking about. You keep coming here, right? And he's not leaving you alone. You feel uncomfortable and you feel confronted by the Spirit of God. If that's you today, I'll simply just tell you this. God is not trying to hurt you. He's trying to heal you. And you can find healing only through him, because he is not just a way. He is the way. Not just a belief system, a direction, a path, and a journey to follow.